Begin by just referring to that video that we saw there a few minutes ago, the Bethel one. First of all, it was Hannah and Danielle, kind of, between the two of them that put it together. But more than that, I just wanted to, like, the people who were talking about staff, right? And so we're never in need of campers at Bethel because it's always full, but we are in need of staff. And so particularly, I guess I look at the upcoming needs. We don't have a head cook for teen camp yet, which is just 3 weeks away, and we don't have much kitchen help next weekend for soccer camp. So anyways, if you are wanting to come and help at camp, we would be glad to have you. And so just talk to me afterwards, and that would be good. Okay, let me start this morning by reading to you part of a poem. There's a little insert in your bulletin if you hadn't noticed it there. Well-known poem that we even actually looked at a little bit in the first service here today, as it happened. Some of you could quote it. According to Google, far and away the most sought-after poem in all of English literature, 4 times as much as any other poem. And that's Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken. I just want to read part of it. And it says here, and you can quote it in your minds as you're listening, right? Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. Sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. And then took the other. And then skipping down to the end, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Published in 1916, so 100 years ago. In all of our lives, numerous times we come to crossroads. Crossroads in our life, the same as what this poem is talking about, in times when we need to choose between one or the other because you can't travel both, right? Back at Mother's Day, you might remember we did some would you rather questions here, which we won't do right now, but like, you know, would you rather have hiccups all your life or would you rather sneeze all your life? You know, that kind of question. Well, the kind of crossroads that we come to are usually a little more consequential than that. You know, there's a little more to them. And so we need to think about what we're going to do at those times. So we're going to be starting today a series that kind of off and on over the course of the summer where we're looking at a number of unconnected, different stories from the life of Christ. Not as a progression, sort of, but as an intent to look at each one by itself and see how he dealt with one concern. And so then altogether a number of concerns, which are very much a part of our lives as well. And hopefully, excuse me, these will be talks that will speak to where our feet land, be very practical kind of things that helpful to us as we continue to live for him. And the idea and some of the passages that we'll be looking at come from an old book of Chuck Swindoll's called Christ at the Crossroads, and you may have seen it at some point in your life. In it, he looks at a number of situations that Christ was in the middle of, that he was part of. And sometimes he was the main character, and sometimes he was helping somebody else. Crossroads where a choice had to be made. And so the crossroads we're going to look at, the occasions in our life, when we need to go one way or another, will include what we do when we're faced with temptation, when we're faced with loneliness, with guilt, with discouragement, with compromise, with pain, things like that. Andreas is going to look at doubt a little bit from a number of different perspectives, with some apologetics. What do we do when we come to these points in our life? Because we know from our past experience that they're going to come, and we have them. And we know because of that that they're going to come again, and we're going to have that sort of thing happen in our life. So what do we do? Well, to start with, I think we'd all say, well, what does the Bible say about it? But, you know, not everybody would say that. Something you probably heard people say, or at least heard of people saying, if you haven't heard it yourself, is that the Bible has no relevance to the world today. You've kind of heard that kind of thing. Hopefully that isn't the kind of clip that somebody quotes you on, you know. The Bible has no relevance to the world today. Because after all, you know, it was written 2,000, 3,000 years ago, and how could the people who lived that long ago in a society that's so primitive compared to where we are at right now possibly have anything to say that could be applicable to where we're at? You know, it goes on page after page talking about things like blood sacrifices and idol worship and ceremonial purifications and all this kind of stuff. And we think, what has that got to do with where I am at in my life right now? That sort of thing, that's not the 21st century, right? Instead, you know, we've had people who've been on the moon, and we have devices that we carry around in our pocket that you can contact anybody in the world or find out anything that you want wherever you are at any given time. The problems in our worlds are not the problems that the people 2,000 or 3,000 years ago were facing. You know, we have gunpowder and atomic power and AIDS and on and on. We could think about the problems in the world today that really, in a sense, we don't see addressed in God's word at all. It's not the same world in some respects. But you know what? In some, it is. Turn to Galatians 5, just for a couple of verses there. Galatians 5, and this is reading in verse 19. And we read there, "The acts of the sinful nature are obvious. Sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, discord, jealousy, fits of rage, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and the like." I mean, it goes on and on. And he's talking here, Paul, who wrote this to the church in Galatians, saying, this is the kind of thing that you see around you, right? And for sure they did. And you know, we see the same kind of thing in the world around us now, right? And so even though in some respect it's not the same, in another it completely is. We see the very same things happening in the world that happened 2,000 and 3,000 years ago in the time when the Bible was written. And so it does speak to where we're at. And so we can look to the Bible and discover that it can help us in the midst of the crossroads in life, crossroads of fear and pain and loneliness and all the rest of those things that I had mentioned earlier. We do find them addressed. And so we can look here, and so we're going to, and most specifically, at Christ's response to those things, because so many of them as well, we find Jesus responding to those very things. And so we can look and see what he did and how he did, and that can help us to discover what we need to do. Because if we can learn when we come to those crossroads in our life, those difficult times, if we can learn to respond as we see Jesus did, then we'll be able to face them ourselves. Because he faced them in one way or another. I was looking through a book yesterday that I have at home, a classic old book called In His Steps, and some of you have probably seen it, and I'm sure it's in the library. An old Charles Sheldon book that was actually published in 1897, so it's quite a while ago, but quite an excellent little book if you haven't read it. What happens is that the people in one little church in this little town determine that they will ask themselves the question, what would Jesus do when anything comes up in their life? And you'll remember about 20 years ago or 15 years ago, everyone was wearing bracelets and t-shirts and the rest that talked about that very thing, right? Where people would say, this is the question we need to ask ourselves. And it's not a bad question to ask. What would Jesus do in the midst of the crossroads, of the things that are coming up in life? How is he going to respond to them? We need to think about that. Because just like the people in the book, what we see, you know, if you're to read it, the town was changed completely. It was a different town as a result of it, eventually, because of the fact that these people asked that question. And the same can happen in our community as well. Our town can be transformed. From starting with one little church, a bunch of individuals in that church asking themselves that question, what would Jesus do if he was where I am right now? What would be his response to it? And if we see that, it'll make a significant difference to the world around us. We talk, you know, in the beginning of January, we talk about New Year's resolutions, and if we made that kind of thing, but we don't need to wait for January, we can make it now. It would be something that would make a difference to the world around us. And it happens a couple of ways. It happens first individually. We need to make that kind of decision individually. Because much of our life, we're not with each other, right? We're here together for an hour or two on Sunday morning, a few other times scattered throughout the week, and maybe you talk to somebody on the phone and that kind of thing. But for the most part, we're kind of on our own a little bit, right? Other than the fact that the Spirit is with us. And so we have to make that choice, first of all, individually, to be able to ask that question of ourselves. What would Jesus do in the midst of that? Turn to 1 Peter 2:21. Another verse that speaks to us about this. 1 Peter 2:21. And we read there, I mean, this is kind of breaking in the middle of a thought, but anyways, he says, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." And that's where the book got its name from this verse, that we should follow in his steps. I was thinking, as I was dwelling on this yesterday, you probably remember Mother Teresa, right? I mean, she died about 20 years ago, but she was a woman who was renowned for her work amongst the poor in Calcutta, in India. But I read a quote once that Tony Campolo made about her, and this was when, and you'll probably remember this, when she won the Nobel Peace Prize. Remember, she won the Nobel Peace Prize one year. I don't remember when that happened, but Tony Campolo, when he heard about that, he said, "Here's somebody who won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing as Jesus would do in her situation." She won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing what all of us as Christians are called to do. So obviously it's not happening everywhere around us. If this one person who's actually doing it got the Nobel Peace Prize for it, the rest of us aren't doing what we should be. That's a little added on to what Campolo said. But anyways, the point is that it's not supposed to be a rarity like that. This is supposed to be the thing that we're all doing. We're all supposed to be living that way. Not so that only one person does, and as a result, they win a big prize for it. So individually, each one of us needs to be asking ourselves that question. At whatever crossroads we're coming up to in our life, what would Jesus do if he was right where I am right now? So we have to ask that of ourselves individually. But secondly, together. As a community of Christians together, we have to ask ourselves that question as well. Because as we work together for him, as the local church, we also have to be seeking to do what he would have us to do together in all the different parts of what we do together. Excuse me. In all the different programs that the church offers, we need to see how we can be a part of that, how we can contribute, not for just what we can get out of it, but for what we can put into it, because that's what Jesus would do, right? And as each part of the body contributes in this way, then the body as a whole will be stronger and will have a greater witness and will make a difference to the world around us. So both individually and together, we have to ask ourselves that question. What would Jesus do in the midst when we come up to whatever crossroads it is? Because it even happens to a church as a whole. We come up to crossroads and we have to make decisions. And we need to ask that question as we do. Now, we all know that living like Christ would live is the very best thing that we could do. I mean, we know that. But sometimes it calls on a little much from us, and so sometimes it's difficult to do that. In the book, In His Steps, one of the characters is a newspaper editor. And he decides not to accept advertising in his newspaper that is immoral. And so he won't take, like liquor ads and this kind of stuff. He won't put it in, won't have it be in the newspaper. And the paper suffers for it, and his job is on the line. And those were results that could have discouraged him from continuing on in this, right? And the same thing happens to us. You know, sometimes we stand for something, and then it puts us out somewhere. Maybe it's going to cost us, and so sometimes that makes us think, I don't know, I don't think I want to do this. Turn to Matthew chapter 7. Some verses here that help us to see that God knows what he's doing when he lets things come up, and we can still stand for him in the midst of that. Matthew 7, and these are verses that are pretty familiar to us. Matthew 7 and verse 9, and we read there. Which of you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you're evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Sometimes we think, you know, when something comes our way, we think that God is giving us a stone, right? And what are you dropping this thing in my lap for? How is that going to be any good for me? How is that going to help me at all? But that's because we're looking at where we're at right now. We're looking at the results that are just sitting on our lap at the moment. But we need to learn to look at the bigger picture and see that God does know what he's doing. I was thinking of one of Johnny's books, Johnny Erickson. And if you haven't heard of her, I mean, she was a lady, and this was a long time ago, but anyways, when she was young, she had a diving accident and so was paralyzed as a result of it. And so in her books, you know, that she writes, she talks about how very bitter she was to God. How could you let this happen to me? You know, she her quality of life was changed, and she thought, this isn't fair, I can't have this. But later in her life, she realized that this was the best thing that ever could have happened. Because for her, it was what she needed to get her spiritual life back on track. And that's what really mattered. You know, as I thought of her story, I was thinking of a nephew of mine. And this, again, was some years ago, but when he was about 14 or 15, he was quite athletic and getting more into athletics and this kind of thing. And then he broke his leg. And it was a bad enough break that they had to put a pin in it. But his body rejected the pin over, and they kept trying it over, and it was about a year and a half before finally his leg healed. And he still has a limp as a result of it. I don't know, just wouldn't accept it. John could probably tell you why. But probably about a year later, he came to me, and he was talking. He said, you know, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because I was getting more and more into this athletic stuff and getting further and further away from God. And as a result of not being able to do it for a year and a half, his life was renewed. And his Christian stand was there again. So sometimes we think that what God is giving us, what is he doing this for? But just because we can't see it right then, we have to trust that God knows. And one day we'll see that God has a purpose in what he has let come our way. And so when we're trying to discover why, we'll turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Just a few verses there that help us to see, you know, when we're trying to determine what's a stone and what's bread and that kind of thing. 2 Corinthians 4, and reading in verse 16, and it says, Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, what is unseen is eternal. So if we're trying to figure out what's a stone and what's bread and what does God have for us, well, the things that contribute towards eternity, according to these verses, are the things that matter. And that's the bread that God has for us. So when we're trying to decide what God would have us do in any situation, well, if it's something that that contributes to eternity, we know that that's what it is. And I was thinking even of Jesus' life. You know, if you look at his life and the story of his crucifixion particularly, if he had looked to see how that was going to affect his life right then, and that's all he was thinking about it, well, he would have walked away from it, because obviously if you're crucified, it's going to affect your life. But he was looking at it in the bigger picture and seeing, what is this going to accomplish? And there's so much more that came as a result of him taking that next step, that he was willing to do that. And so we can see, I mean, what would Jesus do? He looked ahead. He looked to see the bigger picture, instead of just thinking of what's this terrible thing that's dropped in my lap right now. He can offer salvation to us as a result of that, because he was more concerned about us. And so we have to try to keep that perspective. in all we do. Think of what God has for us. What does it mean in the bigger picture? I think the reason that we struggle sometimes with what we should or shouldn't do isn't so much a struggle of wondering what is right, because usually we know. It's more a case of whether we're ready to give up control to God or not, right? We know something's the right thing to do, but we see that it's going to have this negative effect on us, and we think, no, I want it to happen this way, and so that's what we do. Turn back to 1 Samuel 13, and we see this in the life of Saul. 1 Samuel 13, and reading at the middle of verse 7 is a new paragraph, and it says, Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. The enemy was out facing them, right? He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel. Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings. And Saul offered up the burnt offering. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived. Saul went out to greet him. What have you done? Asked Samuel. Saul replied, when I saw that the men were scattering, you did not come at the set time, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor, so I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. You acted foolishly, Samuel said. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. Saul knew what was the right thing to do, right? He knew what he was supposed to do. Samuel even said it to him specifically, and he knew, and if he had just waited a few more minutes. But he took things into his own hands because he thought, I gotta push this, right? And so he did, and as a result, he lost out on so many blessings. The kingdom passed from his family to David's, you know, and that's one of the things he lost out as a result of this, of not being willing to trust God. And to trust what God had said to him through Samuel. So we need to do this. We need to be able to trust God. We need to give total control to him. And then only will we be able to live as we ought when we give control to God. But it's easier to say than do, right? It's easy to say that and recognize that. But we need to see that that's the case. I mean, it goes right back to the garden and beyond, even. When Satan was sent out of heaven with, I can do it on my own, and Adam and Eve, I can do it on my own, and we kind of tend to say the same thing ourselves, right? I can do this on my own. But we need to see that we can't. And we need to look to God. We need to give him control. But that takes total faith, right? It takes a lot of faith to totally put your life in someone else's hands. I was thinking yesterday, if you've had surgery, especially, let's say, life-threatening surgery, and think if you would have wanted to put your life in the hands of a doctor who was trained at the Mickey Mouse School of Medicine, you know, or something like that, and you probably wouldn't, right? You say, no, I don't think I'm going to do that. But somebody who was trained properly, you would. Well, God is somebody who we can trust. He wasn't trained at the Mickey Mouse School of Medicine. God is somebody who we can feel confident putting our life in his hands because he wants the best for us as much as we want it, even more. And so we can be confident as we come to him. So despite the fact that the world seems to have progressed so much, mankind is still beset with the same kind of problems that they always have been, even though they're kind of different. If we look to Christ's life on earth and how he responded to those problems, we can find the answers that we're looking for. We need to ask ourselves the question, what would Jesus do? And then do it. Not just answer the question, but do it. And it'll make a difference to those around us. To do that, we have to have complete faith in God, trusting that he knows what's best for us and will bring it to pass, even when things don't seem to be as we think they should be. Last weekend, we had 33 youth in Edmonton at YC, about half from here and about half from other youth groups or other kids who come to youth group. And the Saturday night talk that we had was by a man named Heath Adamson, who I hadn't heard of before YC. And he looked at a story from Mark chapter 5. I want you to turn there with me just for a few minutes as we close here. It was a good little point which I had not ever noticed previously. Mark chapter 5. And Mark chapter 5 is the story of the Gadarene demoniac. And let me read part of it. Mark 5, and I'll read, well, starting at verse 1. They, that is Jesus and the disciples, or was it? Yeah. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot. But he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." And then jump down to verse 16. Those who had seen it, so he cast out the evil spirit. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much your Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. So the people from where this man came from, they didn't want to have anything to do with Jesus. "Go away from here. We don't want you here. Please, we don't want to see you." So that's where this man came from. Then we go to down to verse 18. Oh, no, I read that. In chapter 6, sorry. Chapter 6 and verse 53. So the end of chapter 6. And this is a little while later, and this is at the end of the story when Jesus walks on the water, which, you know, when you think about it, I mean, he wasn't in Canada and it wasn't winter, so it was pretty amazing to be walking on water. All right? So Mark 6 and verse 53, and we read there. So Jesus gets onto the boat with his disciples after walking on the water. In verse 53, it says, "When they had crossed over, they landed at Gennesaret and anchored there. As soon as they got out of the boat, people recognized him. They ran throughout the whole region and carried the sick on mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, into villages, towns, or countryside, they placed the sick in the marketplaces. They begged him to let them touch even the edge of his cloak, and all who touched him were healed." Now, this is the same place where just one chapter before, everybody had said, "Stay away, we don't want you around here." And so the difference was, one man had gone back to this place, in today's terms, he was the only Christian there. And then a chapter and a half later, when Jesus comes back again, everybody wants to see Jesus. They had seen the difference that this one person had made. They wanted to know about this Jesus and see what he had done. He had won everyone over because of the change in his life. So when Heath Adamson was speaking at YC at this point in the story, he said to the kids, you know, thinking of this man, of the Gadarene demoniac, he said, when Jesus sent him home, he sent him with something to do. And then he said, "You're going home from here, from YC. And you don't know right now what God is going to call you to do, but are you ready to say yes? Will you say yes before you even know what the question is?" And that's kind of what he put out to them, you know. And as an aside, all 33 of them said yes. But let me ask you today, as you are ready to go home, will you say yes before you even know what the question is? Whatever crossroad you're standing at right now in life, will you say, "Yes, Jesus, I want to do what you want me to do"? Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you that we have the opportunity to respond to you because of what Jesus did for us when he came for us. And so we thank you for that. more than all. But I pray that you would help each one of us see the wisdom in saying yes to you, in seeing that you know what's best for us better than we do ourselves. So help us to say yes, even before we know what the question is. Help us to say, I want to do what you would do. Help me to do it. So I pray that you'd speak to each of our hearts here today, and that the message would be from you. Help us to say yes. And we pray in Christ's name. Amen. So Kevin.